Well, let me see if I can find my place here. What a week, huh? I don't know if you had a week like I had a week, but David and I had talked over who was going to, I think the guys have all had a schedule for a long time or sometime on who's preaching next, who's doing what, and so I had another date and David had today. The chapter 19 was David's time. But he went left town. And on the way out, he said, "Stan, would you pick up that for me?" And I said, "Oh, sure, sure. Have you read Matthew 19? That is a tough one. And how do you deal with that? And the subject is on divorce. Wow. Divorce. So let's just start right here. Holy Spirit helping us here today. In verse 1, when Jesus had finished saying these things, he left Galilee and went to the region of Judea on the other side of Jordan. Large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. So Jesus has been doing a whole lot of things in Matthew. Healing the crowds, telling them what they need to be doing. He's teaching his disciples. This is a great teaching thing for them. He has spent a lot of time bringing them up. He gets on their case when they don't do it. He said, "Come on, guys, you got to get this. I am not going to be with you forever. You need to start grasping these things." Especially with the food deal. He said, "They're hungry." Jesus said, "I don't want them to go away hungry." He said, "You guys feed them." He said, "You do it." They didn't know what to do. They said, "All we have is a few fish and a couple of loaves, you know." He said, "Well, bring it to me." That's a key word that I have seen through scriptures, and Jesus always makes that statement, "Bring it to me." When you bring it to him, he makes it happen. So here we are. And it said in verse 3, some Pharisees came to him to test him. So these are the Pharisees. They ask him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Just pick something. Is that okay?" "Haven't you read," he replied, "that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, 'For this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united with his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate.'" Okay? And so, they were right there. Well, why then? You're making a statement. Why then, they asked, "did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away?" Wow. Jesus replied, "Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard." You got a heart problem. And you didn't know how to handle it. God let that be. Moses permitted it because you're hard hearts. "But it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman commits adultery." Now, we've heard this bounced around quite a bit down through. I've talked to people and what their thinking was on adultery. And, yeah, you are if you've been divorced and remarried. And they get into all kinds of what I call scribes and Pharisees situations. And there's a real life that you and I have to live. We need to understand that. The disciples said to him, "If this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it's better not to marry." This sounds like a too tough a deal for me. I don't want to go there. So Jesus replied, "Not everyone can accept this word, but those to whom it has been given. Some are eunuchs because they were born that way. Others were made that way by men. Others have renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven." They wanted to go out and preach the gospel, and they didn't want to have to deal with a wife. But they were busy with the things of the kingdom. What did Paul say? Remember what Paul said on this subject? Paul said, you need to be like me, not married. Because he said, then you can come and go as you please. God can speak to you and you can send you wherever he wanted you to at a moment's notice. If you're married, not so easy. Now, some of the disciples did take their wives on mission trips. It's like, would be very difficult. Especially in those times, we're not airplanes or boats or cars like we have, so it was difficult. He said, the one who can accept this should accept it. The ones that can handle this, you should handle it. So this is a tough question. This is a tough one to handle. And I'm saying, okay, where does one start? What does one do? So I was thinking about this, and we're talking about the Jews. We're talking about Jews and what they have and what they had to say. First thing I asked was, who are the Pharisees and Sadducees? Because they're the guys that's been giving Jesus a bad time all along here. And I said, they stood for both beliefs and policies, which were the law. The Pharisees lived life according to the very smallest, minute thing of the oral and scribal law. They didn't miss a note or a letter. The Sadducees rejected the oral and scribal law completely, not what we believe, and accepted only the written words of the Bible as their law of life. Difference. The Pharisees believed in angels and the resurrection of the body, and the Sadducees did not believe that. Two different groups, two different ideologies. The Pharisees were not a political party and were prepared to live under any government which would allow them to observe their own religious principles. As long as you let us do what we do, you're okay, no matter what government is in charge. The Sadducees were the small, wealthy aristocracy. They were the rich people. They had a lot of money. They could kind of do what they wanted. Who were the collaborating party. They were quite prepared to serve and cooperate with the Roman government in order to retain their wealth and privileges. Remember that? They said, hey, if we don't do something, you know what he's going to do? He's going to mess everything up for us, and we're going to lose our place, and the Romans are going to throw us out, and we're not going to have what we need. We got a good thing going here. Let's keep it going here. Further, the Pharisees looked for and longed for the Messiah. Okay? The Sadducees did not. Somebody has said, you know why they call them the Sadducees? Because they didn't believe in the resurrection, and they were sad, you see. I'll just throw that in on you. But you know, you couldn't have found two different groups, right? These two guys at opposite ends of everything, the ideologies, thinking, who Christ is, what the Bible's all about, what they thought the Jews needed to be. But they came together. I don't want to call them Democrats and what you call this, but they came together for one desire, and that was to eliminate Jesus. Get him out of the way. He's causing problems on both sides of the story, because every time something comes up, what can you say against him? He's healing people left and right. He's doing all kinds of great and marvelous things, but we got to do something. So that's when these two groups came together, and they were starting to question Jesus on everything. And this was one of them, one of the main things. That's the problem. I said, all error has its common. That is, it's hostile to Christ. That's the problem. So, I said, how will I attack this? And I said, okay, we're dealing with the Jews. We're dealing with what they had to say. This is a Jewish nation. So I did some looking, and I came up with Josephus was a Jewish historian. And he just happened to be a guy that it was 37 A.D. to about 100 somewhere after the death of Christ. So he's right in this range, knowing what's going on. He's a historian. So he writes about these things. And I like what he had to say, so I'm just going to read you a little bit about Jewish marriage and divorce. How is it? What is it? How does it work? It works the same for you and me, only in a modern, more modern time. It's the same thing. We're dealing with people. So there was really, even in the modern time, there's just no coming together among the Jews and the Pharisees. They were just trying to get Jesus in a controversy. I just said, no nation has ever had a higher view of marriage than the Jews. They had a very high thing. Marriage was a sacred duty to remain unmarried after the age of 20, except in order to concentrate upon the study of the law, was to break a positive commandment. And that was to be fruitful and multiply. So, he who had no children, quote, slew his own posterity. Didn't have any children. Obviously, you don't have any. And lessen the image of God upon the earth. You are the image of God upon the earth, right? You got to remember that. When husband and wife are worthy, the glory of God is with them. Marriage was not to be entered into carelessly or lightly. We say that. They said that back then. We're saying it today. Same thing. So if we take a look at the Jewish marriage based on the Mosaic teaching, a man, they say, is the antiquities of the Jews, a man must marry a virgin of good parentage. He must never corrupt another man's wife. He must not marry a woman who has been a slave or a harlot. These are things that the Jews said, hey, these are important to us. Let's think this through. You and I might take well to take some of this very much to heart. If a man accuses his wife of not being a virgin when he married her, he must bring proof of his accusations. Can't just throw words out there, guys. You got to bring some proof. Her father or brother must defend her. These are all the Jewish, this is what they laid down for the Jews. If the girl was vindicated, he must take her in marriage and could never again put her away, except for the most flagrant sin. If the accusation was proved to have been reckless and malicious, he said these things and they weren't true. The man who made it must first be beaten with 40 stripes, save one. And take you out and give you a beating with 40 stripes. We're going to hold back and give you just 39. Be nice to you. You know what they did to Jesus? You saw that. It's one of those kind of things. So you better get your act together, the Jews were telling him here. This is the law. And you must pay 50 shekels to the girl's father. It's going to spread lies around. It's going to cost you 50 shekels and 39 stripes. I don't think you want to be doing that. If the charge was proved and the girl found guilty under Jewish law, if she was one of the ordinary people, the law was that she must be stoned to death. Wow. 39 stripes start to look pretty good against stoning to death, doesn't it? But you'll find out that women were had a very lower place in life. They still do today in these other countries. And if she was the daughter of a priest, she must be burned alive. These guys were pretty stiff. These are the regulations they had. If a man seduced a girl who was espoused to be married, and the seduction took place with her consent, both she and he must be put to death. Can't be caught that way. If in a lonely place or where there was no help present, the man forced the girl into sin, the man alone was put to death. You did it, you should not. If a man seduced an unspoused girl, he must marry her. Okay? Or if her father was unwilling for him to marry her, he must pay the father 50 shekels. Better come up with some money, guys. Don't just So the Jewish laws of marriage and of purity aim pretty high. There's some real serious things that occur. Ideally, divorce was hated. And God said so. Remember Malachi? I'm sure you all have read Malachi 2:16. God said there, he said, I hate divorce. I hate it. I don't like it. I don't want you to do it. God says he hates it. He said, you've got a bad heart, you guys in Malachi. So you guys are bad news. He said, if you don't straighten it out, he said, I might strike the world with a curse. We may be in some of that now. I don't know. Anyway, God says in Malachi 2:16, I hate it. I hate divorce. It was said that every altar wept tears with a man divorced the wife of his youth. But ideal and actually did not go hand in hand. In the situation, there were two dangerous and damaging elements. First, in the eyes of Jewish law, a woman was a thing. We use that term a lot, right? I'm a thing, or you're a thing, and we got this thing. They were a thing. They weren't anything but a thing. She was the possession of her father or of her husband, as the case might be. And therefore, she had technically no legal rights at all. You're under somebody else, you have no rights. Women. Most Jewish marriages were arranged either by the parents or by professional matchmakers. Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Remember? Okay. A girl might be engaged to be married in childhood and was often engaged to be married to a man whom she had never seen. The parents make a deal. I remember a story, I probably don't have time to get all this in. When I was working with a guy he was from India, and he was saying that he worked with me in a company down in South Carolina. And he said to me, he said, hey, my family's coming out. And he said, I know, I called him on the phone, and I said, I'm coming back there for a vacation, and I want you to pick out some ladies for me to come see so I can take them out, and I'm looking for a wife. And all the guys down there said, what? You're going to have your mother and dad pick your wife or pick somebody? He said, what's wrong with that? You know, he said, well, you got to get the right cast with the right position in life. You didn't want to just marry anybody. And they were all these southern boys said, well, where's the love in that? Love. He said in front of us, what does love have to do with it? What's love got to do with it? Fascinating. They just couldn't, somebody else is going to pick your wife. They just couldn't handle that. Same thing here. There was this safeguard. There was this safeguard. When she came to the age of 12, she could repudiate her father's choice of her husband. I don't like him, Dad. Don't want nothing to do with him. I love it. So there was it wasn't all that hard. But in matters of divorce, the general law was that the initiative must lie with the, husband. The law ran like this. A woman may be divorced with or without her consent, but a man can be divorced only with his consent. Can't divorce me unless I say so. See, that's how it was. Woman, no. The woman could never initiate the process of divorce. She could not divorce. She had to be divorced. No wonder they went around like this all the time, you know? They never get it right, right? You can't divorce, but she had to be divorced. Jewish laws. There were certain safeguards. If a man divorced his wife on any other grounds than those flagrant immorality, he must return her dowry. If he divorced his wife on any other grounds than those flagrant immorality, he must return her dowry, and this must have been a barrier to an irresponsible divorce. I'll just get married. Give me the money. You got to give the money back. You better not have had a good time with the money because you're going to have to give it back. Or some stripes are going to be for you. The courts might put pressure on a man to divorce his wife in the case, for instance, of one, refusal to consummate the marriage. You don't want to do that? We'll get a divorce. Or impotence. or prove inability to support her properly. Dad can look at her and say, hey, you ain't got what it takes, boy. You're not going to marry my daughter. No, sir. Can't do it. Consummate that marriage. Consummate it or the inability to support her. A wife could force her husband to divorce her if he contracted a loathsome disease. Obviously, leprosy. You know, and that's a good thing to get divorced over. Or if he was here's an interesting one. I never thought that. If he was a tanner, right? The guy that takes cow hides and puts them through all the processes and makes leather out of it. Don't want to do that. Here's the problem. Which involved the gathering of dog's dung. Gather up all the dog poop, make leather out of it. Probably it was the chemicals that were in it. You know how they were, you don't wash your hands? Oh, man. Remember that Jesus got on to him about that in the last few chapters. He said, you didn't wash your hands. He said, you insulted them. He said, it's not what goes into a man, it's what comes out of a man. The words you say, the actions you take, that's what defiles you, not what you eat. Jesus made that real clear to him. But anyway, it's just fascinating, but I didn't know that. Or if he promises to make her leave the Holy Land, take her out of God's promised land, not going. But by the laws, the law was that the woman had no legal rights and the right to divorce lay entirely with her husband, pretty much on him. Unless you do something stupid, and then things start to happen. But basically, she has no rights. I think that's pretty much true in the Eastern religions. Some of them today have little or no rights. That was the first one. Second, the process of divorce was fatally easy. The process was founded on the passage of the Mosaic Law to which Jesus' questioners preferred. When a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, something wrong, and he writes her a bill of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of the house. Here you go. Here's your card. You're gone. But that's Deuteronomy 24:1. The bill of divorcement was a simple one-sentence statement. I like this. One simple statement that the husband dismissed his wife. Josephus, this writer here, writes, he that desires to be divorced from his wife for any cause whatsoever, and many such causes happened among men, let him, the guy, in writing give assurance that he will never use her as his wife anymore. For by this means she may be at liberty to marry another husband. Give her divorce, she can go. One safeguard against the dangerous ease of the divorce process was the fact that unless the woman was a notorious sinner, her dowry must be returned. If she was just an ordinary housewife and all this, you got to give the money back. Don't spend the money, guys. You better put it in the bank and let it collect some savings if you plan on not doing that. The money must be returned. This is a Jewish grounds of divorce, Matthew 19:1-9, which we just read. One of the great problems of Jewish divorces lies in the Mosaic enactment. That enactment states that a man may divorce his wife if she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her. The question is then, how is the phrase some indecency to be interpreted? Well, I didn't like this. I didn't like that. Oh, I don't know, is that a bad thing or a good thing? I don't know if you got your story right. Okay? On this point, the Jewish rabbis, they were, the scripture said, violently divided. Oh, man, how are we going to handle this? And it was here that Jesus' questioners wished to involve him. Hey, we'll give Jesus this one. This is a tough one. We'll give it to him. He can handle this. So there's two schools of thought. The school of, it's called Shammai, were quite clear that a matter of indecency meant fornication and fornication alone, and that no other cause could a wife be put away. Okay, makes some sense. Let a woman be let a woman be as mischievous as Jezebel, so long as she did not commit adultery, she could not be put away. Okay, that's what this Shimei group was all about. On the other hand, the school of, I call it Hillel, interpreted this matter of indecency in the widest possible way. They said it meant that a man could divorce his wife if she spoiled his dinner. Man, you burnt the beans. You're in trouble. You know, if she spun, if she went, unbound her hair or spoke to men in the streets, if she spoke disrespectful to his parents, hey, speak to dad about mom and dad. Or she was a brawling woman whose voice could be heard in the next house, you know. That's a sign for divorce with that group. There's a rabbi by the name of Akeba. Even went to the length of saying that the phrase, if she finds no favor in his eyes, meant that a man could divorce his wife if he found a woman whom he liked better and considered her more beautiful. You know what? I'm walking down the street and I found a girl more prettier than you. So, hey, man, I can do it. I believe in this group, not that group. This is crazy. I'm reading you things that you think is crazy, but this was the law. This was the Jewish law. Wow. The tragedy was that it was to be expected. It was a school of Hillel whose teachings prevailed. The marriage bond was often lightly held. We're getting married. If it don't work out, hey, we'll just move along. And divorce on the most trivial ground was sadly common. Happened all the time. Hey, yeah. Did you get divorced? Yeah, I did. You didn't know who was doing what. That's the Jewish law. It was too easy. To complete the picture, certain further facts must be added. It is relevant to note that under rabbinic, under the rabbi's law, divorce was compulsory, you must. Two reasons. It was compulsory under the rabbi law, was for adultery. The woman who committed adultery must be divorced. You know, you got to. That's just what we say. Second, divorce was compulsory for sterility. Sterile. That you got to. The object of marriage was the procreation of children. And after 10 years, a couple were still childless. Divorce was compulsory. Hey, you guys been married 10 years, no kids. What's going on? You guys need to get divorced and start again. Wow. It's Jewish law. In this case, the woman might remarry, but the same regulation governed the second marriage. Nothing happened in the first. How about the second? Another 10 years, there better be some children. Otherwise, you're going to get divorced. Under this group. Two further interesting Jewish regulations in regard to divorce must be added. They had more regulations than a... First desertion was never a cause of divorce. Okay? Never a cause of divorce. If there was desertion, death must be proved. You've been deserted, somebody must have died. You got to prove that. I'm not sure quite how you did that. Bring the body back, I don't know. The only relaxation was that, whereas all other facts needed the corroboration of two witnesses in Jewish law. You're going to corroborate something? You need two. One witness was enough to prove the death of a partner in a marriage who had vanished and not come back. The guy takes off, another one comes back and says, yep, hey, he's gone. I made a check and I don't know where he went. Secondly, strangely enough, insanity was not a grounds for divorce. You got a husband or a wife that went bonkers on you. Could not divorce. If she was divorced, she would have no protector in her helplessness. If she went insane for some reason, or she could not have a divorce because she's going to need help. She can't handle it by herself. That's the point. No divorce. There was a certain point of mercy in that regulation. If the husband became insane, divorce was impossible. Interesting. The guy goes off the deep end. You can't get a divorce. Listen to the thing. For in that case, he was incapable of writing a bill of divorcement. He's out of his mind, man. He can't write a bill of divorcement. Right? This is what they did. And without such a bill, initiation by him, there would be no divorce. If he hadn't got the good sense to sit down and write one, you can't have one. You're out of your mind, boy. And that's just one of the questions. When Jesus was asked this question, at the back of it, there was a situation which was vexed and troubled. He was to answer in a way which came as a staggering surprise to both parties in the dispute, which was suggested a radical change in the whole situation. This is Matthew 19:1, the answer of Jesus. In effect, the Pharisees were asking Jesus whether he favored the strict view of the Shamrai or the laxer view of the Hillel. How are you going on here, Jesus? What do you think about this? Any old thing, or got to do more things? What do you think? And hereby seeking to involve him in a controversy. Let's get Jesus to answer this. That way, we'll get him. Jesus' answer was to take things back to the very beginning, back to the ideal of creation. In the beginning, he said, God created Adam and Eve, man and woman. Inevitably, in the very circumstance of creation story, Adam and Eve were created for each other and for no one else. Their union was necessarily complete and unbreakable. Now, says Jesus, these two are the pattern and the symbol of all who were to come. That you need to get a grasp on. It is a pattern and a symbol of all who were to come. Each marriage couple is a reproduction of Adam and Eve, and their union is therefore no less indissolvable. Should not do that. The argument is quite clear. In the case of Adam and Eve, divorce was not only inadvisable, it was not only wrong, it was completely impossible. Think about it. There's just two. How does it, who's the other third party here? There is no third party. For the very simple reason that there was no one else for whom they could possibly marry. You've got two, that's it. Therefore, Jesus was laying down the principle that a divorce is wrong. Thus early, we must note that it is not a law, it is a principle, which is a very different thing. Just think about Adam and Eve gives me a thought about, when you think about that, it was God that made the statement, Adam shouldn't be alone. It was God that said, he needs to help me. It was God that created one. It was God that brought them together. It was God that initiated the marriage. It was God that did the whole thing. It wasn't anybody else. It wasn't any law. Only God. God himself did it. It was quite different. Quite different. Okay, here at once the Pharisees saw a point of attack. Moses in Deuteronomy 24:1, right? Said that if a man wished to divorce his wife because she had found no favor in his eyes and because there's some matter of indecency in her, he could give her a bill of divorce and the marriage was dissolved. Mosaic law, that's what you could do. Here was the very chance to fire. The Pharisees needed some answers and clarity. They didn't know. So they're going to get Jesus trapped in this. They would now say to Jesus, here's what they're thinking. Are you saying Moses was wrong? Moses didn't have it right? Are you seeking to abrogate the divine law which was given to Moses? Are you saying something different than what God gave to Moses, our forefathers, our great Moses? Are you setting yourself above Moses as a lawgiver? This is what they're thinking in their head. We need to go talk to Jesus about this. See where he stands on this so we can trap him into something. This is their thinking. Jesus' answer was that what Moses said was not in fact a law. Moses didn't say, this is the law, guy. This is what must be done. But nothing more than a concession. I concede to you because of your hard hearts. You guys are so bad, you won't listen. Moses did not command divorce. This is what you do. Just what you got to do. He didn't command that. He said, you can do that. At the best, he only permitted it in order to regulate a situation which would become chaotically promiscuous. Do what you want. You know, hey, I thought you were married to her. No, you're over here. What are you doing over in this house? You know, the whole thing could just run wild, run rampant. He said, no, Moses said. The Mosaic regulation was only a concession. I can see that because of your hard hearts. Because of the fallen human nature. Human nature got to the place where you got to do something. It's going to be chaotic if you don't. Genesis 2, 23, 24, we have the ideal which God intended. The idea that two people who married should become so indissolvably that they are one flesh. Jesus' answer was true. Moses permitted divorce, but that was a concession in view of a lost ideal. What's the lost ideal? Not to do this. Treat each other right. Do the right thing. But it was a concession for a lost ideal. The ideal of marriage is to be found in the unbreakable, perfect union of Adam and Eve. That's your example. That is what God meant marriage to be. Now, this is what we face with one of the most real and acute difficulties in the New Testament. What did Jesus mean? He came back and said a few things, and what did he say? Even more of a prior question, what did Jesus say? There's some difficulty. I went through these and looked these all up, and I'm saying, yeah, I see there's a difference. The difficulty is there is no escaping it, that Mark and Matthew report the words of Jesus differently. Okay, Matthew says this, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for unfaithfulness and marries another commits adultery. Matthew 19:9. Mark has, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. You gotta think these through. Luke still has another version of this saying. Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. I have sat and talked to people about these subjects, and they get off on one tangent, and you cannot convince them any which way. This is what I believe, and I don't care what anybody says. I said, well, the scriptures, they don't want to hear it. That's what it says. Depends on Matthew, Mark, Luke. So, this is what they said. You can read it yourself. There is a comparatively small difficulty that Mark implies that a woman can divorce her husband, a process which, as we have seen, was not possible under Jewish law. Under Jewish law. He says you can, but under Jewish law. But the explanation is that Jesus must have well known that under Gentile law, different set of rules, a woman could divorce her husband, and in that particular clause, he was looking beyond the Jewish world. Jesus making these, he knew this. A great difficulty is that both Mark and Luke make the prohibition of divorce absolute. Absolute is what you do. It's cut and dry. With them, there are no exceptions whatsoever. But Matthew has one saving clause. I guess depending on which one you pick. Divorce is permitted on the grounds of adultery. Let you do that. In this case, there is no real escape from a decision. The only possible way out would be to say that in fact, under Jewish law, I underlined that, divorce for adultery was in any event compulsory. Right? We talked about that earlier. Under Jewish law, if you have adultery, it's a must. You've got to get divorced. No way around it. As we have seen, and therefore Mark and Luke did not think they need to mention that. But then so was divorce for sterility. Sterile. You get divorced for that. Got no children. somebody for whatever reason. In the last analysis, we must choose between Matthew's version of this saying and that of Mark and Luke. We think there is little doubt that the version of Mark and Luke is right. Little doubt. There are two reasons. Only the absolute prohibition of separation will satisfy the ideal of the Adam and Eve symbolic complete union. You have to go back to Adam and Eve again. And the staggered words of the disciples imply this absolute prohibition. For in effect, they say in Matthew 19:10 that if abstinence continuance, that will not be the way for the ordinary man, but the world would be a poorer place if it were not for those who accept the challenge to travel alone for the sake of the work of Christ. Need to do that. It would be wrong to leave this matter without some attempt to see what actually means for the question of divorce in the present time. What's it mean now? We may at the beginning note this, that Jesus laid down a principle and not a law. To turn this saying of Jesus into a law is gravely misunderstand it. The Bible does not give us laws. It gives us principles which we must prayerfully, intellectually apply for any given situation. What are you going to do about that situation or this situation? Look at the scriptures and see. Of the Sabbath, the Bible says, in it you shall not do any work, right? We know that. You don't work on the Sabbath. Remember the law? That's Exodus 20:10. In point of fact, we know that a complete cessation of work was never possible in any civilization. You ever tried that? You ever lived on a farm? And you've got 10 cows that need to be milked today, fed, milked, put out. In an agriculture situation, cattle still have to be tended and cows have to be milked no matter what the day it is. My in-laws milked 7 days a week. 7 days a week. They didn't go to church when they ever got a chance. In a developed situation, certain public services must go on, or transport will stand still and water, light, heat will not be available. Light's going to be shut off on Sunday. Well, no water, no heat, no anything, guys. You can't do that. We know that. Not be available in any home, especially where there are children. You can't turn off the lights and kids. There has to be a certain amount of work. Has to be some things done. God knows that. Jesus knows that. The principle can never be quoted as a final law. The law is you will. Boy, come Monday, if you don't milk those cows, Katie, bar the door. I mean, you know, or the things that need to be done. A principle must always be applied to the individual situation. What's your situation? We cannot therefore settle the question of divorce simply by quoting the words of Jesus. Jesus said it, I believe it, that settles it. We've heard that expression. So that's me. That would be what we call legalism, right? We call that legalism when you do that. We must take the words of Jesus as a principle to apply to the individual cases as they meet us. That being so, certain truths emerged. Let me give you just two or three of these. Beyond all doubt, the ideal is that the marriage should be an indissoluble union between two people, and that marriage should be entered into a total union of two personalities, not designed to make one act possible, but designed to make all life a satisfying, mutually completing fellowship. Okay? That is the essential basis on which we must proceed. Number two, but life is not and never can be a completely tidy and orderly business. Don't believe me? Have children. That will change it real quick. Into life, there is bound to come sometimes the element of unpredictability. Supposes now. I'm going to give you some supposes. Suppose then that two people enter into the marriage relationship. Suppose they do so with the highest hopes and the highest ideals. We've got this. We've got said all the right things, did all the right things. We're going to do this. And then suppose that something unaccountable goes wrong. And that the relationship, which should be life's greatest joy, becomes hell on earth. Some of you might have seen that, met that, know people. Started out great. Ended up in a junkyard. Suppose all available help is called in to meet this broken and terrible situation. It's bad news. Let's call in who we need. Suppose the doctor is called in to deal with the physical things. We'll call him in. The psychiatrist to deal with the psychological things. The priest to minister to deal with the spiritual things. We're going to fix this thing. Suppose the trouble still be there. It's still there. Suppose one of the partners to the marriage to be so constituted physically, mentally, or spiritually that marriage is an impossibility. For whatever reason, it's an impossibility, physically, mentally. And suppose that discovery could not have been made until the experiment itself of the marriage had been made. Are these then two people? Here's the question then, supposing all of that. Are these two then two people are to be forever fettered together in a situation which cannot do other than bring a lifetime of misery to both of them? We brought in everybody we could. We gave them every effort. It's not going to work. So what do we say? Let's just keep them together no matter what. Let them fight it out or live in different rooms. That's not what we're looking for. That is not the... It is extremely difficult to see how such reasoning can be called a Christian. He's a Christian. You ever go in their house? It's terrible. Called a Christian. It is extremely hard to see Jesus legalistically condemning two people to any such situation. This is not to say that divorce should be made easy. I'm not saying, hey, just... But it is to say that when all the physical, mental, spiritual resources have been brought to bear on such a situation, then all is possible. And the situation remains incurable. And even dangerous. It could turn dangerous. Think about that. Somebody could get hurt. Then the situation should be ended. You need to end that situation before something drastic happens. And the church, so far from regarding people who have been involved in such a situation as being beyond the pale, should do everything it can in strength and tenderness to help them. That's your job. Do all that we can. Do everything that we can. Talk to them. Work with them. Help them. There does not seem to be any other way than that in which to bring the real spirit of Christ to bear. You are his disciples. You're the ones that go to these situations and try to work them if you can. Third, but in this matter, we are face to face with the most tragic situation. It often happens that things which wreck marriages are in fact the things which the law cannot touch. The law can't do anything for you. It's bad news, but the law can't do much. A man in a moment of passion and failure to control commits adultery and spends the rest of his life in shame and in sorrow for what he did. That he should ever repent his sin is the least likely thing in the world. Another man is a model of rectitude in public. To commit adultery is the last thing he would do. And yet, by a day-to-day sadistic cruelty, a day-to-day selfishness, a day-to-day criticism, sarcasm, and mental cruelty, he makes life a hell for those who live with him. And he does it with callous deliberation. Let me ask you, what would you say to that couple? You don't have to, but just think about that. You go in there and this guy's bad news all the way around. He has no good words for anybody. What would you say? We may well remember the sins which get into the newspaper, and the sins whose consciences are most glaringly obvious need not be in the sight of God the greatest sins. To just because it hit the paper doesn't mean that's their greatest sin. Many a man and many a woman wreck the marriage relationship and yet present to the outer world a front of impeachable rectitude. Things are okay. They're not okay. This whole matter is one which we might well bring more sympathy and less condemnation for all things the failure of a marriage must least be approached in legalism and most in love. Legalism will just kill it. It won't work. Love is what it's going to take. Jesus made that very clear. In such a case, it is not a so-called law that must be conserved. It is the human heart and soul. That's what we're about. What is wanted is there should be prayerful care and thought before the marriage state is entered upon. Think it over before you get married. See how it is. See how they are. See how their families are. See how everything is as much as you can. Entered upon. That if a marriage is in danger of failure, every possible medical, psychological, spiritual resource should be mobilized to save it. Does that make sense? Hey, just go see a doctor and you'll be all right. Wouldn't that be an easy out? But if there is something beyond the mending, you've gone, you've seen, you've talked, you've done, you went to the scriptures, you did all that you could, the situation should be dealt with, not with legalism, rigid legalism, but with understanding love. You gotta love them. Understand, see what's going on. There's no easy out. If you work with one of these other groups, yeah. And we do that today, right? It's fairly easy. It's not that easy just to write a little note and say, here you go, hon, see you later. We don't do it that way now. We have lawyers and we have things. We have courts. We have people that handle these things for you. Don't even have to show up. That's not what it's about. That's not what Jesus came to do. The scribes and Pharisees, they didn't have it. They're looking for a trap. They're looking for a way out. They were just concerned about their own lives, their own things. They didn't care about the people. Jesus was standing in their way. He's always going to stand in the way. Let's pray. Father, we thank you. Your word is forever settled in heavens. We do not have all the answers, but you do. You sent your Holy Spirit. You said if we would ask him, he would lead and guide us into all truth. In fact, you said if we say anything about God or Jesus, that'll be forgiven us. But if you say anything about him, the Spirit of truth, it will not be forgiven you in this life or the life to come. So we must tread lightly on what your word has declared and what you have given us, not to enter into these things without prayer, talking to your word, talking to each other, without a love one for another. And I thank you for your word. Let it be a blessing and life to them that find it. Amen.